Sam, this is supposed to be a conversation. So let's see how we can make this work. I'd like to maybe just start, Sam. I mean, you're a newcomer, at least to many people in the business. Maybe you could just give a little bit of your background and explain to us how you got into the real estate business.
Sure.
For starters, and then we'll move on to another tough question.
It's great when I get questioned by one of my lenders on the one. It's fantastic. Good afternoon, everyone. So I started, my background is I'm an entrepreneur. Started when I was in high school in the import-export consumer electronics business, and I did a number of startups throughout my career. From there, I was in the retail sector doing high-end retail stores in the dry cleaning and commercial laundry. I also did startups in the financial sector. But throughout my startup career of doing a number of companies over the last 20 years, my passion was always real estate. And I actually started in real estate back in 1989 after my first company that I started in consumer electronics and started doing land assemblies in Richmond Hill and rezoning works and property amalgamations and then getting them to draft plan approval for sale to other builders. Then in 2007, I really started to resonate to me in terms of what the market opportunities were, especially specifically in Toronto, in niche markets, and formed our construction company as well, and vertically integrated, doing both the assemblies, the rezoning, the construction, the sales and marketing, and all of the post-delivery works as well, including the property management of our properties. The most current ones are in Yorkville at 133 Hazelton, 181 Davenport, and of course started out doing low-rise custom homes in Forest Hill, Lytton Park, and many other areas throughout the GTA, and then from there graduated into the high-end custom mixed-use developments that we're seeing now, such as One Bloor.
Great. Thanks, Sam. Maybe what we could do, just before we get into the conversation, I know a lot of people here may not be aware of what the project is called, The One, and you're right, I'm a lender so on this project, so I obviously want to make sure everything works out the way it should. So, Sam, maybe you could just talk briefly about the project and what some of its basic specifications and physical description of the property, and then maybe walk from there into the vision that you've established as you've created this property.
Sure. So, you know, the ones, as everybody knows, it's located in the southwest corner of Yonge and Bloor. I consider it one of the most important intersections in Toronto, if not the country. This is the nexus of Toronto in terms of the subway, Yonge and Bloor subway lines, the pedestrian count, vehicular count, the high street retail that's there for Bloor Street that starts from there and goes both west and east and north and south. And it was a very unique opportunity to do a land assembly. This was off market. None of the properties were on market. And we assembled the properties over 9 months and put together a vision for it that was going to be very iconic and very different. It was a game changer event for Toronto. And I'll get into that in a minute. But the property is basically, the development for the site is an 80-story building. Even though we say it's 80 stories, it's more the equivalent of about 120 stories, 125 stories, because we have very high ceiling heights. It's at 304 meters, it makes it the tallest building in Canada, and one of the 10th tallest buildings in North America. We really went out to look at assembling a world-class team to do this, and got the architect Norman Foster from London, from Riverwalk, and assembled a team that we'll get into in a few minutes as well. But the real game changer about this building is that it's bringing something to Toronto and Canada that's unique, which is 8 stories of vertical retail, and creating a very special type of retail that we'll get into as well. On top of that, we've got 4 levels of underground parking with full valet services, concierge, security, and so forth. And then on top of that, you've got essentially 72 stories of residential, which is going to be custom designed and so forth. So we've got a building that's over 1.2 million square feet, and creating something in terms of form and function that's very unique in terms of its exoskeleton structure, the unique ability to be able to create a retail experience for international global retailers that they've never really been able to achieve in Toronto. The building was really reverse engineered with the customer in mind, both the tenant or tenants and the homeowner and homeowners. So what we did is we wanted to create uncontaminated retail space. And when I say uncontaminated retail space, I mean by that no columns, no pillars, basically a vast expanse of space that the tenants can come in and basically have a magic wand to design any type of space they want for their customer experience without really limitations that you normally get. And most of the international retailers were looking to come to Toronto and build flagship stores, but they didn't have the opportunity to because most of the real estate on the Mink Mile and Yorkville were older buildings from the 60s, 70s, 80s, many columns, many different, you know, zigzags in the building, and they weren't able to really create that customer experience that they wanted with the high ceiling heights, the vaulted ceilings, clear glass, pedestrian realm, and so forth, and that's where the vision came for creating the retail. On the residential side, the most problems with most condominium developments is that you're really limited in terms of how many units and what you can bring to the product offering to the homeowner. So you have four or five different plans, and that's it. What we did with, again, the structural engineering of the building and how we did it similar to the retail, is we created the magic wand for the homeowner to actually come in and be able to custom design their unit. If they wanted two bedrooms, three bedrooms, one bedroom, they wanted to have 600 square feet, 6,000 square feet, or anything in between, they had the ability to be able to customize that and actually make it into a custom home, which is what our background is. And that's unprecedented in the condominium world because normally you have limits in terms of where you can place your kitchen, where you can place your washrooms, and you have to stack this as you come down the building. We don't need to do that in this building. We can put one kitchen on one side, a washroom on the other side, have it on the other floor, and it won't interfere in terms of the stacking effect because of how we've designed the building. So those are all very unique aspects of it. The other thing that we've done with this building, which is very unique, is we created something called the Winter Garden for the residential. And that's very unique because Toronto, as we know with our climate and weather, most condominium buildings, if you're up on the 60th floor, 50th floor, 30th floor, any floor, you can only use your balconies or terraces for maybe 6 months out of the year. The second problem is as you go higher up, the wind becomes a major issue on these high rises. And you really can't enjoy the balcony because of the high winds. We designed a new concept called the Winter Garden, which basically allows you to use your balcony and terraces 12 months out of the year, 365 days, regardless of what the climate is. It's a double-sided glass conservatory which opens up, it's heated, and it allows the homeowner to be able to, doesn't matter if it's snowing, it's minus 20, it's raining, whatever the situation is, they can actually come out, open up the first glass doors, it opens up in a panoramic and you've got the outside air and fresh, and you can use it in any climate. And that's very unique because, again, Toronto and North America has not really seen that in terms of the concept. And at the same time, it has wind protection. So even if you're on the 80th floor and you're over 1,000 feet in the air, you're protected from the wind and the velocities of what's happening. And of course, we're connected into the path connection through the subway, going into the artery of the Yonge and Bloor subway line, which makes it very unique. We created a very large public realm with the sidewalks that are extremely wide and generous. Part of that is because of our anchor tenant, and you know, they're building a global international flagship store there, and we're expecting very large volumes because of the intersection of just being at Yonge and Bloor and
Sam,
a destination.
Just when you talk about the retail, I mean, you look at eight stories. I mean, how does eight stories make any sense? I mean, everybody, I'd say 90% of the people in this room would look at you and say, "Are you smoking something? Like, what's going on here?" First of all, where did the idea come from, and how is it? How's the leasing going in terms of the retail portion of the property?
So, you know, the story, you know, the vision of vertical retail is not new. Vertical retail has been around for a long time. Many cities like Hong Kong, Japan, Europe, and other places in the U.S. has vertical retail and multi-story. It's new to Canada. And it was very challenging for myself, especially when I was looking at financing this and actually buying it. And when I would say it's eight stories, everyone would be very, you know, saying, how is this going to work? The new retail format, if you look at, of the global international retailers, such as H&M, Uniqlo, Apple, you look at Chanel, Louis Vuitton, any of the international global retailers, and you look at where and how they're building their new retail formats, they're multi-story. If you look at the new Uniqlo store that opened on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, New York, it's over four or five levels. If you look at the H&M store that opened up on Fifth Avenue, it's multi-level. If you look at, so these are just ones in New York that are close, but all of the new global flagship stores, even Louis Vuitton, if you look at LVMH and their group and what they're doing in Paris, what they're doing in London, what they're doing in Chicago on Michigan Avenue, they're all multi-level flagship stores, because the new retail format of international retailers is to create a brand experience store. So they're transforming them where, you know, they want to create an environment where the customer can come in and experience their brands, because now they're doing everything from menswear, if you're taking apparels, to women's wear, to children, to home living, and they want to differentiate these sections within the space. At the same time, the format has been changed because they want to create a wow factor for the customer experience. And you can't do that on a single level. If you look at our Mink Mile or Bloor Street, our retail was single floors, you know, that worked in the 70s and 80s and 90s, but today it's much more complex, the offering is much more broad, and the international retailers came to us, really, and told us what they wanted, and we engineered and reverse engineered this retail based on what our tenants wanted. So our tenants taught us what to build, Stuart.
What did they tell you they wanted?
Our anchor tenor said, you know, we want 2-3 stories, we want to have 25,000 square feet. We want to be able to have ceiling heights that are 34 feet and 20 feet, and we want to have no columns, no pillars in them. The other one said the same thing. We want 20 foot clear, no columns, no pillars. We want to have glass that's 200 feet going one direction and so forth. We want to have parking. We want to have subway access. We want to have all these different factors. And what we did is we actually took all of this information, and our customer taught us what to do. And we reversed engineered the building to what the customer wanted, what the tenants wanted. Same thing happened on the residential. When I was building the buildings at 133 Hazleton and 181 Davenport, we sold those buildings out in under 9 months, or close to 9 months, both buildings. And this was at a time when the condominium market was already saturated and everybody thought we were gonna have a bubble and so forth when I started this 4 years ago. And we got unprecedented sales per square foot. We were over $1,200 a square foot average in the building, sold the buildings out in under 9 months, and everyone said, you know, how did that happen? It happened because we listened to our customers. The customers told us, we don't want small units, we want to be able to combine and have the flexibility to have whatever we want in the units. We want to be able to custom design our units to what we did, and we did that. We said yes, 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 and we allowed that freedom. And case in point right now, for the one, we have not gone to market officially on the res, because we've been pre-leasing the retail. I'll get back to your question.
Which I want to get an answer to.
Right,
that.
I'm going
to
give you that answer. But we have right now over 2,000 people that have registered, pre-registered for the residential for 416 units. And that 2,000 people are real local area codes and addresses. They're not investors from overseas or people. These are end users that we've identified because the way we've done our system. And I think that speaks volumes to the customization and the what this building's going to be able to offer. In terms of getting back to your question on the retail, we're right now approximately 60% leased and in LOIs for the building, and we're moving towards 100% over the next few months. But you know, the challenge is where everybody thought that, as you know, that you're going to have difficulty leasing the upper floors. And right, you're going to have a major issue with floors 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, and anything there. You're never going to get the rental rates that you think you're going to get. And, you know, no, Toronto hasn't seen it, and it's not going to happen. You know, I'm very pleased, as you're privy to know as well, we have an anchor lease that has taken up the entire ground floor, the entire concourse that we've done, which is binding. We have LOIs for floors 4 to 7. Which everyone thought were going to be the biggest challenges, and we got those done. And we're right now entering into LOIs for the level 8 and for 2 and 3, which basically puts us at 100% leased. And these are with international global retailers that are creating the ones of industry in this building, which really Canada hasn't seen.
How did you attract them to the second and third floor? What kind of, I mean, do they have any exposure there really?
It's a great question. There was a number of elements that attracted them. One, having the anchor who we have being there was one major thing, because this is one of the most important retailers in the world. The other one is the fact that the adjacencies that go along with that. But how do we get the vertical traffic up? Is you need to create a visualization and a customer experience that allows for those retailers to be confident enough that they can move that vertical traffic up for the ones that have done it before in many cities and know about it. And again, I point to New York, Chicago, Japan, Hong Kong, Asia, London, many places where we've seen this. And one of the things we did that was very unique is we put in very special glass. I don't know if you've seen the video yet, but I brought a presentation that's looping, and we created something called Safar. We basically are putting in a technology here called Safar Glass. The Safar Glass that you see, actually you can see this right now in the image that you see up on the screen that's on the retail portion that looks like this crisscross that's coming through. That's actually not three-dimensional glass, it's actually one-dimensional, looks like it. But it's an LED screen, 4K high-definition fabric that's embedded between two screens, and it creates a complete high-definition TV video that creates emotional content for the retail users that are on floors 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and basically creates branding for them that's over 250 feet on Bloor, 250 feet on Yonge, and creates an emotional content that allows for those tenants and those stores to be able to attract the pedestrian experience that come up.
Is that really expensive?
Very. It's cutting edge technology. It's opaque glass, so you actually can see through, as you can see in the image, you can see through the stores and see people inside the stores and see the shopkeepers and so forth. The people inside the store and the shoppers inside the store can see out, so it has about 50%, 40% opaqueness. But what's very unique about it is, as you walk away from the store and you're outside and you're, you know, 200 feet, 300 feet as you come up, the screen becomes solid and you basically have what you're seeing now, this emotional content that allows for the retailer to actually put on emotional content into the screen and put in the advertisement of what they want that attracts you that comes in. This is very cutting edge in terms of what's been done.
How has the city responded to the signage issue? Does that create a signage issue, or?
Well, it's part of our site plan application. It's part of our zoning application. We're actually at the city right now.
And by the way, how's
I'm actually at the city. I'm supposed to be there right after this. We've got our community council going on today for zoning. So
we can jump back to the building, but just talk to me about the zoning process and
sure.
The development permit process that you're going through.
I'm very grateful. It's been a 15-month process. That started. We put our application in last March of last year, and we're at Community Council today. And we got a positive staff report from the city planning approximately 10 days ago, recommending the approval for the site. And that was a lot of hard work. We had a lot of challenges. There were a lot of issues that we needed to resolve. We created working group meetings, Stuart, with the community, the stakeholders, the resident associations, the GIRA, the BIA, and we spent basically 15 months listening to what all the concerns were and all the challenges were with the site and the development and the building that we were going to do, and really addressing those needs. They were everything from shadow studies on the parks that we were casting because of the height of this and the massing of this building, to the wind velocity and the wind that we would create at Yonge and Bloor, to basically the density that we were building, the parking, the traffic, the capacity on the sewer systems and everything else. And we spent 15 months going through with all of our consultants and all the resident association, really building a rapport and building a relationship with them, and going through one by one those questions and those concerns and addressing them and actually evolving the building over 15 months. If you saw what the first building looked like and where we are today, there's been many evolutions to that. And that came because of the collaboration we did with the community and all the stakeholders to listen to them and evolve the building and change the building to... And I think the process actually created a better building. I think it actually, this whole process, everybody thought, you know, when I was going through it and our team, I mean, it was very challenging, but it actually evolved a much better building. And I'm actually proud of it today from where we are today because of that process than where we started working with them. But
Are you still fighting with those same residents associations? Or what's
no, we actually got them on side. So they're the resident associations in support. And they're at Community Council today supporting the application and recommending the approval as per the staff planning report. But there's always going to be those that are going to be objecting to change and objecting to this building. And I'm sure there'll be many groups that will still not be happy even though this is done. But at least I know in my heart of hearts, Stuart, that we worked with them We sat with them across the table. We tried to mitigate as many of the issues that there were, and we're still doing it, and we'll still look at how we can evolve the building and do something better to appease everyone.
Is there anything unique that you did through this process to expedite it or to get the approval that you were looking for? And did you do things that might be a little different and unique in the development business?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we did there were a number of things. I can touch on two or three points that strike my mind, you know, that are very different. One of the things we did that was very unique is when you're doing a development of this size or any size, you've got parkland dedication to deal with and deal with the city with parks. You've got to deal with heritage. You've got to deal with many different aspects. But the two things that were very unique that we did that I think were sort of revolutionary and that got the support of the city behind us was, I'll take parkland dedication as one example. So when you're doing developments, you've got to allocate a certain percentage to parks, and most developers will put cash in lieu of that, and you pay X dollars, and it goes into the parkland fund so they can use it for the park. So we came and we said, look, the city already has a lot of cash in there, and we'll contribute to that as any other developer would, but why don't we help you actually get parks and actually create green spaces? And the city said, you know, wow, this is a very unique thing. And we said, you know, you're looking at expanding your parks, you're looking at assembling parks, but you're having challenges getting them. So we assemble lands, and as a developer, can we help you assemble what you are looking for? And we'll buy it, we'll turn that into green park and basically assign it to the city and have that as part of our parkland dedication on top of any cash payments we did. That was revolutionary. They loved that because the skill sets that you need to go do that, sometimes you don't have all those skill sets or the bandwidth to do it. So we have undertaken to do that. We took one of the properties of which we acquired off-site, and we're transforming that into a green space and then transferring to the City of Toronto, which, for example, dealt with the parkland dedication or a portion of it. The second aspect was heritage. You know, the site had many issues with heritage on it, with stoleries and other things that I'm sure we all read about. It was like a nightmare for me to deal with when I first bought the site, but we, you know, we dealt with it very, very well with the city, and actually went ahead and designated 774 Yonge as a heritage building, even though it wasn't yet designated, and incorporated that architecture into the design that you see on Yonge Street in some of the renderings, and we actually took the stones from stoleries that we had that were, you know, over 100 years old, and incorporated them into the building along with the family. And I had done that actually even before. It was part of the plan even before we closed on the building that we were going to incorporate that and put that in. So those are the aspects. We also created a public realm. We've got 9 to 11 meter sidewalks that we've set up, and we've actually taken away from our own property and created a very large public realm on Bloor Street, on Yonge Street, to create a real destination. What we wanted to do here was to create something that was going to be a wow factor for not only the city but the country. You know, you look at New York, you know, you've got the Rockefeller Center, you've got the Empire State Building. You look at many different cities and they've got these iconic architectural buildings that tourism comes to and the community looks at, and they've got a wow factor to it. And we wanted to create a destination, an arrival, a building that was going to be measured in that same way.
Okay. What about the project's financing? This is a big deal. You've got to pull together some financing. How's that going for you?
Well, it's financial engineering. I mean, this is one of the lenders up here. it's going actually. It had a lot of challenges early on. We started out with basically, you know, getting everybody to believe in the vision and believe in the retail, because that was the hardest component of it, especially the vertical. And, you know, over the last 15 months, we were able to secure the leases, prove out the retail, especially on the higher floors, and be able to now attract great lenders and great construction financing terms that are now, you know, believers in the project and believe the project's a go. Specifically because we got up to 60%, 65% pre-leased, and the waiting list we have on the residential, it's now allowed us to have much more significant traction on the financing end, and to be able to get the project to construction now. And we've got term sheets that we're looking at now and solidifying, and then moving the project forward for the fall. So we're quite excited. We came a long way from when we started, when there were a lot of non-believers. And even today, you know, you sit back and you go, you know, it's hard to believe how much we've come and the challenges we had to overcome to get to where we are today. But I'm proud to say that we've overcome many of them. There's going to be still many others that I can't even think of that will come up. But I would say we've made a pretty big segue into that today.
So talking about the construction financing, you probably, like many people in this room, have never built an 80-story building. You know, you hear people say, well, how's he going to do it? How can Sam do this? He hasn't built a building like this before. How would you answer that question?
It's true, I would say.
Because your lenders are going to ask the same question, right?
Yeah, they're right. You know, I haven't built a building of this size. Actually, nobody in Canada has built a building of this size, so I'm not alone in the room. But there's many that have built many, many tall buildings. I've really assembled an incredible team around me. I've got Fosters. We've put in a world-class team who have built many buildings of this size globally, from Dubai to New York to Europe and Asia, and we brought in sort of the best team, what I call the A-plus superstar team, and put them together along
with... You mean your consultants?
Our consultants, as well as partnering with one of the top, three top general contractors in Canada. And we're partnering with them, so they'll be CMs with us, construction managers with us, who have built many buildings of this size, and it's become a collaboration and a team effort between ourselves, the top three construction managers and general contractors in Canada that we're partnering with, along with the international consultants who have done this all together. So it's a cohesive team that has formed over the last 15 months. And I'm proud to say that we've, we don't know what we don't know, and there's going to be many things that many challenges that'll come up. But we have made incredible progress in really designing the construction methodology. And there's a video in this which sort of show how the construction's being done, and a quick video that sort of shows how we're going to get the retail open first, and then continue to build the residential and do it in two phases. But you're really building this. We're starting with really building a four-level underground parking. Well, we've built that before. 181 Davenport's a four-level underground parking.
There's a fair bit of structure in there.
Fair enough. And then we're building an eight-story building because we're going to do the retail first. And we built 12-story buildings. And our partners and everyone else have built 60, 50, 40-story buildings as well. And then from there, we're doing something called a jump system where we're going to be building 16 stories at a time. So there'll be a jump system coming up, and basically 16 stories at a time, sort of like Lego coming up, we'll be building it. And that's part of the exoskeleton, it's part of the way the structure's done, and it allows us to build these phased construction, and it mitigates a lot of the execution risk. We're also not going below the water table, we're above the water table. The water table's 23 meters below, we're at 21. So we've mitigated a lot of the execution risk and things that could go wrong with the project to ensure that we won't have a lot of the issues that a lot of the other developers or a lot of the other buildings have had when we're doing the construction. So we learned what not to do.
Okay, so a couple of more questions and then that'll be it. Sam, one question is, when looking at the residential side, you've obviously got a little different vision than a lot of other developers here in terms of instead of having your choice of five different boxes to live in that are somewhere between 250 and 450, take your choice. You're obviously coming at it differently. Who is your market on the residential side? Who are you trying to target? Are you targeting offshore investors? There was a discussion this morning with George when a huge amount of foreign money coming in into the country to buy condominiums or users, or what's your strategy in this regard?
Well, Toronto has, I get asked this a lot, and Toronto has over 100,000 people coming into the city every year, into the GTA, I should say. And that's really what's kept our condominium market and residential market buoyant, even through 08, 09, and so forth. There's still a very strong demand for it. Our demographic is, this is a... this is an aspirational living building. It's a very unique building where you're able to really do anything. You can walk to the art gallery, you can walk to the museums, you can go to the University of Toronto, you're within distances of the best hospitals on university, you've got movie theaters, you've got restaurants, you've got the subway to be able to take you anywhere without ever having to come up. It really is creating a true city building, community type of building. Our customers, based on the demographic that we've attracted in the 2,000 on the waiting list, plus what we're hearing, is everyone from really 20s in their 20s to their 70s. It's an incredible mix of professors from University of Toronto, doctors and nurses and surgeons from the hospitals, to the investor, the downtown core and the financial district of homeowners that are looking at it. So we've got a broad mix, and I think that speaks to the building and speaks to urban living. And being at Yonge and Bloor in this unique building, where these are homeowners who want the valet parking, they want the concierge services, they want to have 5-star boutique hotel amenities.
What about foreign investors? Are they going to be?
I'm sure they're going to be. We
or
have
investors
not,
in yeah, the property.
We haven't seen them on our registration list. What's unique is we don't have one foreign investor in any of our buildings. In our buildings at 133 Hazelton and 181 Davenport, 99% are end users. There's only one or maybe two units that are owned by locals who are renting it. Everything else is an end user that's been in. That's very unusual. Same way in this building, I think you will have a lot of renters, but I don't see the foreign investor pool that everyone's talking about. We haven't attracted that. Most of what we've attracted has been local. Not to say that they won't buy in there, but we're very selective of how we're marketing it and how we're doing it. And this is really catering to the families, to the end users, to people that are looking to live there, that are more than just the investor units from foreign.
Okay. Well, time's running short. I have one last question for you, Sam. What keeps you up at night?
I actually sleep well at
Honestly,
night.
Honestly, what keeps you up at night?
I actually sleep well at night. It's when I'm awake that I'm worried. It's delivering on my promises. I would tell you what really keeps me up or concerns me is just, it's really delivering on all my promises. And there's a lot of challenges. There's a lot of moving parts to this. And it is new. It is visionary. We're doing a lot of cutting edge things in this. But this is a game changer for Toronto and for the city and for the country. I'm very grateful to be part of it, and I'm very grateful that I can have my finger in it and to be entrusted with it. There's a huge moral obligation with it as well, to do something with this corner and something great. And it's really not making a mistake or being able to fix any mistakes or anything that we see as it comes by, because we don't know all the answers to a lot of the questions and a lot of things, but we're figuring them out as we're going. And it's really just delivering on the promises that we've made to our stakeholders and to everybody that's involved, and being able to build this building and have it become something that we're all proud of, not only as a city but as a country, in terms of for the community, for the area, and for what we're doing.
Good. Well, I was here this morning for George Karras's presentation, and he finished it off with a very interesting commentary, think big and be creative. And to be honest with you, I think you're seeing one of the most creative guys in our industry in the country. And I think I know him well, and he's delivered on all of his promises up to this point in time, and I'm sure he'll continue to do so. So if you could join me in thanking Sam for...
Thank you.
For
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.